After leaving Alberta, the water enters Great Slave Lake, and it passes through the Yellowknife region in the Northwest Territories before heading up to the Arctic. Now, this area has been occupied for thousands of years by First Nations people. Mackenzie came through here, and it was a fur trading post for a while. But the real boom happened in the 1930s with a gold rush, and it's been a kind of boom and bust situation ever since. Gold mining has made a big mark economically in this region. It's also made a big mark in the environment. Here's the name for a white. One of the starkest examples of industry in conflict with the environment is the Kolomak mine. It was dropped into the federal government's lap after its owner, Royal Oak Mines, went into bankruptcy. You could only get to Kolomak by plane, and as we flew out of Yellowknife for the 200-kilometer trip north, I couldn't believe how much water was below us. From the air, it's easy to see what we've been told over and over by the scientists, that 80% of Canada's water is up north. When the mine site came into view, we could see the buildings and the tailings ponds, which are heavily contaminated. The contamination of the Kolomak mine is all right here, actually. It sort of looks like beach sand, but what it really is are tailings. This used to be rock, and it was ground up into a very fine muck to get the gold out. They used very harsh chemicals for that. Cyanide and other really nasty things. How do you like this one? Cyanide is used because it's one of the few chemicals that gold will react to. It's used to separate the gold from the rock, but at the same time, it releases arsenic, also found in the rocks. This toxic mixture is what's left behind in the tailings. These tailings are simply dumped into a nearby lake, contaminating the water, but also causing concern for the area's wildlife. So this is where the gold came from. It was dug out of a giant open pit that's about 150 meters deep to the very bottom. Now, the company only operated this mine for 4 years, and then they just left. And they left us with a rather large mess to clean up. Now these pits are being used as holding tanks for the contaminated water from those mining operations.
The contaminated water, we tested a couple of processes at the pilot plant stage last year, and they work. So we've got those options available. We're very interested in a natural process or enhanced natural processes for treating water.
The natural process Octavio's talking about involves putting algae to work and eating the arsenic. To make the algae grow at the right level, fertilizer in the form of phosphorus is put into the ponds. Octavio estimates this procedure will take 6 or 7 years to remove the toxins. But the arsenic's not just in the water, it's on the ground as well. Octavio's team is working to keep the tailings contained, treat the water so that it's suitable for discharge, and when that's been done, provide a spillway where the clean water would then leave the contaminated area and into the environment. The total estimated cost? Between 60 and 70 million taxpayers' dollars. The job is made harder by a leak in one of the tailings pond dams. The seeping water must be captured and continually pumped back in at a cost of $3 million a year. If it weren't contained, it would end up poisoning the 1,400 Dog Rib inhabitants downstream at Fort Ray. Just outside the city of Yellowknife is the Giant Mine. It went into production in 1947 and closed in 1999. Now abandoned, it leaves a legacy of poison. Some 237,000 tons of it have been stored underground in the mined-out shafts. Getting rid of it safely is going to be one of the most drawn-out and costly cleanups in Canadian history. When Giant was closed, it was sold to another company, but its lethal underground stash remains the responsibility of the Federal Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development. It was always thought that the poisonous dust would be safe below ground in the permafrost, but enter global warming.
We We've had about 4 degrees of climate warming at this latitude. We no longer have permafrost that's unmelted to the top, and we have water trickling into the mines and getting mixed with this arsenic trioxide, which is a potential contaminant to groundwater and as the shafts fill up the surface water. So now there's various proposals to contain that water or to get rid of the arsenic trioxide. One of them is a really mad scheme, and that is to put in big refrigeration units and just maintain permafrost artificially. Guess who will pay for that? We, the taxpayer.
The mining companies were never asked to put down much of a deposit for reclamation or emergencies, and the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development is working hard to keep new mines, including the new diamond and base metal mines, from making the same mistakes.
To contain that material now is costing $300,000 a month paid by the taxpayer. That's not to do anything about cleaning it up. In this case, the cost of remediation of the overall project is estimated to be up to $400 million. And of that, they have $400,000 that Royal Oak put down as a deposit on this, so 0.1% of the cleanup cost.
Guess what mad scheme we're using to clean up giant mine? $500 million of our money to put in refrigeration units. It's been approved, they're moving forward. To keep giant mine frozen in perpetuity to protect us from the arsenic trioxide contamination in the mine. $500 million. $60 to $70 billion to fix up Colomac mine. Those two mines have a footprint, a physical impact on the land of a few thousand hectares each. There is currently 5,000 square kilometers. That's 500,000 hectares of oil sands leases out already. And I believe that's an old number, because I'm not sure if you recall, Steph, does that include the newest Shell, Jack Pine, and Horizon, CNRL? So we're probably in the range of 7,000 or 8,000 or 9,000 square kilometers of oil sands leases. We don't have a meaningful reclamation plan. We're taking out areas that are 60%, 50 to 60% wetlands, as Suzanne Bailey said, and she studies and works in that area, and replacing it with a dry landscape, which will be heavily contaminated with naphthenic acids, which are produced in oil sands operations. Naphthenic acids are toxic and corrosive and persistent in the aquatic environment, and we're going to just bury them under a meter of soil. Then we're going to plant a couple of prairie grasses on top and graze buffalo on tens of thousands of possibly, well, no, I'll take that back. I shouldn't have pluralized that. Say 10 to 15 to 20,000 square kilometers, as much as that. The naphthenic acid may uptake in the grass and end up in the buffalo anyway, but, you know, that's not the ecosystem that was there. That's not the wetland that was there. We've already lost 70-80% of the wetlands in the south. Why are we allowing an industry to take out massive areas of our wetlands in the north and take out massive areas of our boreal forest in the north and take out oil to sell to a gluttonous North American economy that won't get more efficient? Piles of it. So I'm frustrated. My dad taught me humor and use humor, but I'm pissed at this point. I'm tired of the lack of care for the environment. And if we don't do something about it, the Klein government doesn't give two hoots. Stefan and I and other colleagues have been reviewing environmental impact assessments for oil sands. And we've looked at environmental impacts on other areas. We have, you know, I have friends in the irrigation industry, but please, why are they still pushing expansion in the Old Man and Bow when we're already over-allocated? And I told them in 1988, and my story's never changed. And if you didn't believe me in 88, how about in 92 and 96 and 2000 and 2004? Your water supply is going to shrink. It's just getting ridiculous. Thank you so much.
Well, we got some problems. Okay, we're going to have another short coffee break, 5 minutes only, and then we're going to come back for the questions and answers. So we really do have some problems. We've had three very provocative presentations. I'm sure you've got lots of questions. Ladies and gentlemen, I would ask you to take your seats again. We're about to start with the question and answer session. The Council on Public Affairs special session. Our topic tonight is the return of the Trojan horse, Alberta, and the New World Disorder. We're about to go into our question and answer session. I would ask those of you with questions, please go to the mic at the back of the room and to state your name and keep your questions brief and to start with at least one question only. Thank you.
Everybody at once. Great. Yeah. We'll ask questions among ourselves.
Good evening, everyone. My question is very simple. There is a chapter in the book, something about media. And for me, really, the thing is the media are key because the public has to know. And I mean, I know it's been separate with the history report on the fire, it's just one means of getting the word out. But in terms of the fiscal situation, the political situation that we're doing, and lots of other things that must be here also in the book that we haven't heard about yet, what media are out there? What is wrong? To no one in specific, so I don't know who's there to answer.
Would you tell us your name, please?
Thank you. I'll take a crack at it. I mean, there's entire books written about the media. Where to start? I mean, I think the corporatization of the media is certainly one big element at a big level, is the fact that you have just massive control of the media, and as we've seen and as we write about in the book, there's far too close of a collusion between corporations at large and governments and the state. And media now is just another one of those large corporations, so you have this kind of unhealthy triangle of the media and the state and the largest corporations in our economy. And they all kind of work together, and they frankly collude. That's a kind of a macro level. At lower levels, I think that there's some problem in terms of, particularly in this province, I think a lot of the media, individuals and otherwise, are far too close to the government. I mean, you know, a functioning democracy requires that the media actually be not close to the government. They should be, in fact, adversaries. There's a lot of people who are far too friendly in the press and other media in this province. We don't have to name names. We know a lot of them are just, frankly, card-carrying members of the governing party. So I think that's a major problem. There's also problems in terms of a lot of people who go into various aspects of journalism, frankly, are not trained to actually ask critical questions. Finally, the other thing I'll say about it is that there's some media just don't do a very good job. They're good at kind of capturing visual things. Right? Jim, it's a wonderful video, and I think it really engages us. But in terms of lots of factual data, lots of times you can't get it through the TV, okay? Because you're immediately gripped in the story, but there's a lot of details that frankly don't translate to TV very well. But we're a visual culture, Okay, so to some extent, people don't have time to actually go into the details of reading, say, financial statements about things. So that's another problem. On the other hand, I must say I do have some hope for the media. I do know some people who I think are extremely good journalists who actually know how to go about and critically examine stuff. For that matter, there's also indie media. One of the really heartening things is the fact that the corporate media, an awful lot of it's going broke. It's not in very good financial shape, particularly if you look at the newspaper chains. I think this is a wonderful thing. Just let them sink, you know, and then maybe we can actually start to have a media again that talks to us, expresses our viewpoints, asks the questions we want to ask, and we'll get the answers of things that we want to know about. Because most of the media right now, frankly, doesn't do it.
Hi, I'm representing, I guess, the Women's Studies Resource Center. My name is Dorothy McKenna. We are right now running the first of what we consider to be a long line of political participation projects. And it occurs to me that each of the three presentations, the issues that were raised, which have to do with the actual oligarchy that we live under right now, or the tyranny, or whatever the heck you want to call it, could be addressed if we could just get people to vote. Now, I don't mean the people that do vote. I mean the people that don't vote. And I was just talking to one of our board members over there, and she said, what if all the women voted? What if the people who were on welfare voted? What if people on age voted? What if the students voted? So I would like you to comment on that. How important do you think that would be on dealing with the problems that were raised by each one of the three speakers?
Good question. Yes, I agree, actually. I mean, if more people voted, that would be a step in the right direction. One of the things I think that right-wing governments, and we have them in all kinds of political stripes, but right-wing governments have actually learned over the last 20, 30 years and done very effectively, is they actually don't want people to vote. They have, I think, systematically gone out of their way to make it more and more difficult to vote, to discourage people from voting, because in fact, and Margaret Thatcher actually proved this in England, quite frankly, what she and her colleagues decided was they only had to win Southeast England and they could win the House of Commons. They only wanted to appeal to a particular constituency, enough of the constituency to win election. And that's basically what conservative governments have done right around the world. They do win when people don't vote. Would it be very different if the poor turned out? Yes. Poor, again, most people know, don't turn out to vote. Would it be different if women turned out to vote more? Yes, I think, you know, almost every survey shows that on a whole series of issues, women do look at the world differently from men. Percentage-wise, women tend to be much more supportive, for example, of all kinds of social programs, of, you know, the quality of life kinds of issues. Men tend to quite often focus on economic issues. Having said that, I think that real democracy and real change will start when we also break from the notion that democracy begins and ends with voting every 4 or 5 years. So although I think voting is something that a lot of people fought and died to achieve, to have the opportunity to vote, we have to actually begin to reestablish democracy at the local level, the community level, associational levels. We have to think of participating in our communities as a daily thing that we do through belonging to various associations. That's how we get our points of view across, not waiting every 4 years for somebody to drop the writ.
Would you like to add any comments to that, or? All right, thank you. Next question, please.
My name is Laurie Walker. I used to be at the University of Lancashire. Question for Dr. Fitzgerald. Do you think that the point when Mr. Ryan shuffled off the stage with the leadership of the protest, the Conservative Party, do you think there's any possibility of using that in order to explain some of the some of the democratic values?
Do you mean within the Conservative Party itself, or? Not what I'm seeing, and I would expect, you know, it's likely Jim Denning is going to be the shoe-in candidate if we get down to a leadership. Now, the one thing I've always preached about Jim is that he did do some really excellent budgets when he was treasurer. Now, by excellent, I mean everything was there and out front and all the background papers, and one could then focus on where one disagreed, which was the political dimension. All the other budgets I've looked at, on the whole, things are hidden or falsified in a way with using the data, as I've alluded to show things that aren't true, in effect. So Jim's always been up front. Jim has been he was really a beacon of education and knowledge in that caucus. But certainly I would disagree with him politically in his directions. So I think any leadership campaign obviously brings more interest to politics. And I think I'd like to reiterate some of what Trevor's saying is that people have to get involved really at the day-to-day level. The most effective citizenry that I've done is I worked on the Canadian Forces Base redevelopment in Calgary. And the City of Calgary had an excellent process of selecting community members to surrounding the area to facilitate that, and it was really a model participatory democracy, and it was extremely successful. The housing in there has won numerous awards from architects and planners and so on, and the public accepted it. It's very hard for the public to take change, you know, in a neighborhood like that. Now, that was at a small scale. I put in thousands of hours in that. Now, it was great fun. It was great of interest to discuss with my fellow citizens on all kinds of dimensions. And it was effective the way it was structured. I would take that any day for the thousands of hours people spend in front of the TV. And I don't see that happening. I don't see, like, this is great. This is fantastic. But I don't see a lot of this. And this should be going on everywhere so that people are informed when they do have to make a vote for a particular party. I'm most discouraged, actually, when one of the demographics mentioned is the youth. I understand youth feeling like, I don't think tonight left anybody with this great feeling of everything's running very nicely here. And the youth have to face that more than someone my age, because it's their environment and it's their political economy and it's their revenues that we're looking at. And they're not engaged in the political processes that we have. They're engaged in other political processes, and that needs to be, you know, that needs to be addressed, so that people feel that they can be engaged and be effective. The example I have of the CFB is the real reward in all that was to realize you had actually made an effect on your community. You had an effect, you were listened to. So much things, we don't feel there's any change or any effect. And in the political process where we have maybe two restricted choices, you know, we don't see a lot of change when political parties change, governments change. We see a lot going on. But there's clearly going to be, you know, when you look at Jim's work, you know, fundamental changes have to occur in the way we live, and it's got to come down to what we do daily in our houses, in our cars, what we drive, how we consume water, and all of these things. So, you know, you have to reach people at that level. And then you want to, if you're willing to take those changes, then you have to work towards electing political parties and leaders who can make that transformation, can affect that change. Otherwise, you just feel it's just, you know, one group for another group. So all I can say is the encouragement at the really grassroots level, and get to knowing people and get to knowing the leaders. And if a leadership contest brings more people into
discuss ideas and exchange, then all the better. So, and they have tend to have that effect. So I don't know if that answered any of your question, but.
Yes, please.
My name is Rena Boss, and I really commend you and thank you for your tremendous effort here. One of the things that disturbed me for the last 2 years is that I feel it's bad enough that we're still increasing capping to the fossil fuel when we've got so much potential to develop clean energy. Now, I know we haven't been given fair royalty, and this oil is our oil. And I thought we should have got in the last 2 years with about $10 to $12 billion more than what we've got. And then today, Trevor informs us it's somewhere between $30 and $35 billion. And that's a huge amount of money. How do we make our government more accountable? How do we get what Norway is getting or what the US is getting?
we'll try to do a kind of a tandem thing here. You can jump in terms of kind of the environmental aspects of this. I think that as I was watching Jim's wonderful presentation, in fact, I'm going to have to get the entire video now. The word I kept coming back to was the idea of externalizing. And a lot of people are now familiar with the term. 15 years ago, they wouldn't have been, probably even 10 years ago. The fact that basically the cost of an awful lot of production, we don't get the full cost. They aren't paid for it. The only way that lots of companies can actually sell all kinds of things from widgets to oil and gas is the fact that the real costs of it are never actually priced into it. I mean, there is a place for markets. Markets could be very effective in terms of, for example, driving out all kinds of really bad things. If you charge the real costs, health costs and everything else for cigarettes, who would want to smoke? You couldn't afford it, right? So you make the true cost of the commodity enough that it actually captures it. So all the environmental costs, all the health costs, all those other things are part of it. We don't do that, and we certainly don't do it in the case of oil and gas. And so one of the things that happens, though, is we're allowing people to develop, produce all kinds of these goods, to sell them to markets far away from us. They make a wonderful profit, and as Jim's video shows, we're left with the cost of it. Whether or not it's tailings ponds, whether or not it's health effects on people, whether it's social destruction of families, all of these things are visited upon us. Why we allow that to happen, I don't know. But we do it again and again. We don't price in the proper cost of these things. So, in terms of royalty rates, yes, we should have had $35 billion more, maybe, at least according to one report. Maybe that $35 billion would have actually helped to pay for some of the costs that we've externalized, that we put onto families, to individuals, onto the environment itself. Maybe $35 billion wouldn't have even paid for the externalized costs. Maybe the true costs actually would have required another $60 billion. In which case, we shouldn't be developing a period. But what we need to do then is to elect people who are actually going to be forward-thinking enough to think in the long term that this is not a society we're talking about so the politician is around for the next 4 years to get elected and then maybe die, right? Because he's not going to care about it afterwards. We have to think about what kind of society are we going to have 50 years, 100 years from now, what kind of development do we want for our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And we don't elect people like that. We elect people who are thinking about the short-term electoral cycle of four or five years, and they buy us off with our money, and we think they've done a great job. Well, we have to stop blaming them about it. We have to take responsibility for selecting and voting for people who are going to do that kind of long-range thinking.
I thought of a John Lennon song. You say you want a revolution. Maybe that's what we need. Actually, I'm going to reply to two key points. Liabilities. I think that we have to work on making corporations liable. If government's always liable, why is government paying, you know, somewhere approaching between half and $1 billion to reclaim several gold mines in the Northwest Territory? So corporations have to recognize the liability, and we put that in some cases to corporations. You better start recognizing and saying to your shareholders that this might not be such a rosy picture if in fact you're developing billions of dollars in unidentified liabilities because you're creating environmental damage. So that's probably, and let's put corporate heads, CEOs, and make them responsible. That's one way to do it. Another way that I think that we have, that we really could make a difference, and I'm going to branch, you know, take a right turn on you here, is quite frankly, we have to have academics return to being academics. The current structure for funding research in our academic institutions is go get a corporate partner. Do you know how hard it is for Stefan and I to find a corporate partner who wants to support environmental work, which argues against the $12 billion oil sands plant? It's freaking impossible. So we really have to change it. I have written in the chapter, I mean, my chapter is, you know, uses the term the silent lie. Academics and corporate heads and politicians are at best naive and at worst lying to us about these future liabilities. And they have to quit lying. And the quote that the chapter starts with, is from Martin Luther King. In the end, we'll remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. We're not speaking out. And I challenge my colleagues. I'm tired of them taking a few bucks to run their damn research programs. You know, let's start speaking out, because the public pays for academics. They pay our salary, and it's our job to speak out on these issues.
I see we have two questioners there. I think those will probably be the last two. So would you please make your questions short and the answers too?
Well, thank you. My name is Art Sanford, and actually I'm kind of torn between two questions today. I have one good one for Dr. Byrne and one for Trevor. But having been involved in a couple of political campaigns last year that they chaired, and it worked very well. But when you talk about Alberta having too many ridings, which I'm inclined to agree with you, and you take a look at the breakdown, that was turned back to the public to do, you know, and they came up with a formula that was plus or minus 25% of an overall average, which the government accepted. But going back to BC, they turned it over to the public and said, no, you come up with a better system. And yet the public couldn't get a system that would work. And by the way, the other thing I would mention, when you talk about the voting patterns, if you were to take a 20-year-old, and if Dr. Flanagan did one of his graphs, and an 80-year-old, you'd find that the number of voters percentage runs almost like that. 80-year-olds, 80% vote. 20-year-olds, 20% vote. What are we going to do about it? The public can't seem to put together a program.
Well, I'll make this very short, my response, because again, it's a huge question. You're quite right in terms of the actual voting patterns. People do tend to vote more as they get older. There's kind of a bumpy ground around middle age as well, but people quite often come back to politics, sometimes quite surprisingly. Some of the most radical people I know are in the 70s and 80s, which is really kind of interesting. So I'm kind of looking forward to that period, I'm going to become radical then. In terms of getting people to in changing electoral boundaries and things, it is a really tough thing. This is a huge province. Let's face it. I mean, Canadian provinces are not small. You can fit several European countries into any one of them. So what you're always trying to balance is the number of people in ridings versus the areas that are covered. But one of the things that has clearly happened over the last number of years is the Conservative Party gerrymanders the riding boundaries so that they can maximize their seat total. And that comes back again, as I said before, this idea that we have a first-past-the-post political system. Effectively, at least one of the ways, if you're not going to change the electoral boundaries, is to change the voting system so that we have a true representation in the House, whether it's the legislature, the House of Commons, wherever, of the interests of the people who are talking. Some people are afraid of that. They think, well, you end up with perpetual minorities. So, big deal. You have perpetual minorities. It's not the worst thing in the world. What democracy is about people actually sitting down and talking. You don't have discussions when one person has the big hammer and the other one's the nail all the time. So what you need is to have a discussion among various groups. I don't care where they come from on the political spectrum. You want to have those voices in the legislature, and we don't have them right now.
Thank you. Last question, please.
Thank you. My name is James Moore. I have perhaps more of a comment than a question, but extremely moving in the block of the presentation. The video, I think when you know, these kind of issues that we're trying to grapple with, you see something like that, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, everyone in the room probably. We want to know also what can we do. We want to sit here and watch it and feel appalled and realize that something needs to be done. If we ask the question, if we want to do something, one thing that I've had the benefit of in my lifetime, I've somehow managed to spend quite a lot of time with different First Nations people, especially over the last 15 years. And when we reproduce a form of cultural geometry, you know, I do expertise of the speakers, not only with their knowledge, but also with their passion, with, you know, the feeling that they have about the subject. These things aren't usually measured. We create a form where, you know, this situation where we're all looking at the back of each other's heads and looking up at them. It seems to me that if we want to do something, the circular form might be more conducive to us getting that feeling for each other where we're all looking at each other's faces. Because if we come out of this room, for example, with the observation that there's not very many young people here, I'm sure that we all could find one or two young people to bring to another forum. But if it's only going to reproduce the same cultural and geometric structure, and it's what we're used to, but when we do it, you know, we walk away, and yes, it was a wonderful presentation, excellent speaker, I was deeply moved, but I didn't really see anyone else. And I'm sure we all, you know, have a lot to bring to a discussion, you know, from our own life experiences, which are very rich. So I'm just, you know, trying to throw that idea as something we can use, creating a more circular format. Second, related to this is the format that we live in, it tends to individuate us and give us this feeling that things are hopeless, we can't do anything, I can't do anything, this one person. It's reinforced by that. Also, the oil sands, what's happening there, this idea of allowing the corporations to externalize costs, the thought that they could be liability for them. Yeah, sure, but the point of corporation is limited liability. So you've got to look at that law structure and this exhortation to productivity all the time. You know, what's his name, Goodale now, making this huge, you know, we have to produce, we're falling behind, and we're falling behind. You can't have both of those. You can't have, look, we need to put not 25,000 square miles, but 50,000 miles because we're falling behind. So if you're going to, you know, look for a balance, then I think we have to look for ways to encourage each other. And that's my comment. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the time.
Your comment about what can we do is the one I'll address. I agree with you. I work with First Nations, and I find the circle format a lot more practical than this in many cases. But what can we do? I hear that from a lot of people. You know, what can we do? And I go, I don't know. Because I'm running as fast as I can doing my job. But I will say that, you know, again, I'm inspired by a lot of great people. I look to wonderful people who have led us in the past. And again, another one of my favorite quotes is from Margaret Mead: "Never doubt, you know, that a small group of people can change society. In fact, it's the only thing that ever does." So get that circle together. Get the people that will help out. You know, I would try to come to the circles where I can, and meet with people and provide information. But you know, I think that's what it needs is a groundswell, people acting, people working. You know, and we just have to become more active. We've dropped that from our lives. We allow government to take care of everything, and I guess you could call it taking care. But you know, there's some cynicism in that, without a doubt. So, you know, please get out there with your groups and please do something.
I'd like to make an observation.
Would you use the mic, please, so that we can record your observation?
I think the problem that we have is a lot of this corporate power, and what should be done is that corporations should no longer be considered people as a person. I think that this is where a lot of the problem is, where the fact that there's no liability when they leave, and when they leave a place like those mines up there. I think that we should be working on that, and if once we could get that, then we would break a lot of the power of the corporation. So that's one place to start that improvement now.
Thanks very much. We're going to... Sorry?
I forgot to give you my name. Hal Hoffman.
Hal Hoffman, thank you. I'm afraid we're going to have to bring the session to a close. I'd like you to join in thanking our speakers with a round of applause. I remind you that you can continue this debate on some of the questions, some of the recommendations, some of just the comments and thoughts via the website, www.sagpa.ca. Next session, which is on Thursday, the regular lunchtime session at Erickson's at 12 o'clock, is Immigrant Settlement Experiences in Lethbridge, and the speaker is Sarah Ames. Thank you very much, everyone, and good night.